In this episode, you'll hear how a single diagnosis can flip your entire divorce case, especially when one parent says, "I don't believe in that disorder at all."
Welcome to Women Winning Divorce, the podcast helping successful women navigate divorce with dignity so you can protect yourself, your children, and your assets. I'm Heather Quick, founding attorney at Florida Women's Law Group, where women win at life.
This week, we have Carrie Pines on the show, and we had a great conversation about divorcing while having children with special needs. I hope this episode is valuable to anyone who might be listening. Stay tuned for the full episode. Welcome to this week's episode of Women Winning Divorce. I'm Heather Quick, owner and attorney at Florida Women's Law Group. Today, Carrie Pines is joining us. Carrie is the founding attorney of Pines Law Group in Los Angeles, California. Carrie specializes in family law, specifically with children that have special needs. And today, Carrie and I will be discussing how to handle disagreements between co-parents about diagnoses, medication, and treatment for a child with special needs, legal strategies and tools to protect your child's best interests during divorce and co-parenting, and navigating evolving care needs, school accommodations, and your own well-being throughout the process. Welcome to the show, Carrie.
Thanks, Heather. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much. I'm excited to get into it. And lawyers are always my favorite because I am still a geek on the law. And especially when you practice in different areas and things can be so different yet similar, I love this discussion. For today, though, or for our listeners, could you share a little bit about yourself and really how you got to even practice family law and, of course, stay in it?
I actually set out to become a prosecutor and was groomed by the DA's office and figured that was where I was going to land. And I did all the right things to get to that position in life. And unfortunately, as it happens every few decades, the DA's office was frozen and they had a hiring freeze, so I could not get that job. So I had to reimagine a career in the law while waiting for them to lift the hiring freeze, which, by the way, did not lift for years and years and years. So I literally found myself in a family law. I took a position at a family law firm thinking I'm going to hate this. And I realized it's about as close to fighting for liberty interests as criminal law is, because you're really dealing with things that are not necessarily monetarily driven. So I was all about helping families get through a crisis. And when the job at the DA's office years and years later finally opened up, I was tempted to take it, but realized, wait, I really love what I do. So my specialty, though, is probably what you want to know about. How did I land this little niche of doing family law specifically in the area of special needs? And that really has more to do with the fact that in my upbringing, I grew up with a disability, and I had to overcome my own medical issues through my education and my career. And then I happened to have two kids. My oldest daughter is on the autism spectrum and had medical issues, open heart surgery when she was a baby. So I faced all kinds of unusual things, had to learn to navigate the educational system and funding sources and all of that. Now my youngest daughter in the last couple of years has developed some medical conditions. She has some autoimmune disease. So I'm learning to navigate that as a parent. And of course, along the way, I went through my own divorce and helping clients identifying issues that I have personally gone through gives me the insight from my own experience and education in the world of special needs to be able to really see the interplay between the special needs systems that we have and the family law system.
Well, and that is, you know, it's so important that, you know, your clients have you as a resource for this, because it's enough, right? Navigating these things for your children, and let's not even get started in the school systems with that part, but then also in a divorce or, you know, post-divorce, just the co-parenting, you know, with those different challenges can, I'm sure very challenging, especially if you and the father aren't on the same page as to how to deal with it. That makes it really difficult.
Yes. In fact, even families that aren't on different pages, even when you've got parents that do approach things in the same way, there's still a huge impact on a family's financial situation, on their childcare arrangements, which parent can work, can't work, creating a custody schedule with a parenting plan and legal custody orders to meld with the actual special needs of each family. Even the most amicable divorces can face challenges that are unforeseen.
So let's start first with really defining, narrowing down, if possible, what counts as special needs, like in the context of divorce and custody, or how as we call it in Florida, time sharing. Let's start there.
Okay. So it's an interesting question because it's very, in my mind and in my practice, it's very broadly defined. You could have the complete end of the spectrum. I've represented the mother of a kid who was quadriplegic, nonverbal, had autism and multiple sclerosis and, you know, nonverbal, non-ambulatory. We can see that that's obvious, right? That everybody would consider that to be a case with special needs. But I see special needs issues pop up in even more nuanced settings, like something as innocuous as a food allergy. It could create an enormous impact on the family, or mental illness, or ADHD, not to minimize those things. But sometimes these issues sneak up on you. They're not as transparent. Yeah. But in my practice, I try to approach intaking families and intaking clients to identify special needs issues as anything that really interferes with the every day-to-day functioning of a family. And it can be a very nuanced, you know, dyslexia or something that's not even getting treated, but somehow will have an impact on either the behavioral issues, the financial issues, or the custody issues.
Right. Now, what are some of the most common legal and, well, this, I should probably separate this because I'm going to say legal and emotional challenges, but let's just talk about the legal challenges you see in divorces involving children with special needs.
Okay, so first, let me just back up a teeny tiny bit and go back to the last question. I would say that in my practice, and maybe it's just Southern California, the most common case that I deal with is a neurodiversity issue. It's a kid who's on the autism spectrum or has some behavioral issues that relate to either ADHD or one of the spectrum disorder type genre. So that's the thing that presents itself most often. And it's also the thing that's most overlooked by most parents. So you ask, what are the common legal issues? So I try to put them in buckets, right? The buckets are how these facts impact the financial issues, how they impact the custody issues, and how they impact the domestic violence issues. Because quite often, these are tools that are used to coerce another parent or to assert pressure. I see the special needs issues come up in all these different settings. So if you want, we can focus on the parenting schedule as the first thing that people usually think of when they wonder how to factor the special needs issue into their case.
Yeah, I mean, and wherever you want to go with it, because I think it's just good for our listeners to understand, right? So if they're on, you know, this is something they're thinking about in the future, just to give them some guidance, like these are the issues that, you know, let's talk about the parenting schedule and the parenting plan. How, you know, what are some of the biggest obstacles that you help clients with and you see that they go through?
Okay. So what I do in almost all of my special needs cases is I give parents a special intake form that I created so I can help. The first thing about these cases is identifying what the issues are. That's the initial challenge, because people usually call me and they have no idea what they're about to, you know, I have a kid, I have a son who has autism, and how is that going to affect my divorce? So I have to break it down by issue. So we'll start with the parenting plan, which isn't really as simple as you would think, right? It could have to do with the kid's actual schedule. Is the kid in a special designated school? Is the kid in a typical school environment? Is the kid homeschooled? That's going to affect the parenting schedule. Does the kid have outside services that need to be factored into the actual schedule? Which parent takes the kids or participates in which therapy, which service? Where are they located? How often does it happen? I have the clients in my intake form give me an actual schedule. What does the kids' week look like? And then I compartmentalize. Okay, we've got, you know, ABA therapy 3 days a week. Where does that occur? It occurs in the home. Which home? Mom's home, dad's home. Which parent is involved? So we factor those. We start with what is the kid's life like? And how do the parents factor into the kid's actual schedule? Now, that's just one piece of it. Then childcare, which parent is working, which parent can work, can't work, who's available to the kids and when.
So this is a little, I'm just curious. And I know, you know, at least here, obviously we have several family law judges. We have lots of different, different counties we operate in. But in general, how do you find the court system when there are these issues with people? Are they helpful in getting them resolved? Or they're like, you guys got to figure this out. Like, I'm not making these decisions.
Okay, so here's a very lawyerly answer. It depends. It depends on whose courtroom you're in and what mood the judge is in that day, right? We've got some very interventionist judicial officers who will make very picayune distinctions for parties. No, the kid will not take that medication. Yes, they will. No, they won't get vaccinated. Yes, they will. Mm. No, they won't go to that school. Yes, they will. But the way California law is structured, we have two different distinctions on custody. We have physical custody, which determines who has the kids when. And we would call a parenting plan part of that. Okay. That goes in the physical custody column. Then there's legal custody, which in California, we refer to as who makes the decisions. Is it a joint legal custody environment where either parent can chime in or they need consent of the other parent? Or is it a sole legal custody situation where one parent is entrusted with making either decisions on all of the issues related to the health, education, and welfare of the kids? Or do we bifurcate it? Maybe mom gets to determine what schools the kids go to and educational decisions, but dad gets to determine the medical decisions. Or maybe mom gets to determine these as to one of the kids and dad determines all decisions as to a different kid. So we can break it up and slice and dice these decisions as needed for each family. And I like to look at all the dynamics of each kid and how it factors into all of these issues. And I try to help the court by really breaking it down. And I think the biggest challenge that going into these environments is they don't really understand, you know, like, I know I've got this issue about dad doesn't agree with my diagnosis, with the kid's diagnosis, for example. But what legal issue does that create? So I help them really by looking at, well, tell me, how has it impacted, you know, what kind of chaos has it created thus far? Well, it's an issue about which school he goes to, or an issue about which childcare provider we can leave him with. It needs to be somebody more highly skilled, or he needs to be on medication. So I have to look at the facts. I have to look at the environment. What have you tried so far? What has worked? What hasn't worked? What's the level of cooperation between parents? This is all information I've got to get from my client. And then if I need to go to court on it, I need to transmit all of this to a judge to say, look, this is where they've been. This is what they've tried. It's obviously not working, which is why we need your help figuring it out. But I also need to give the judge a very concrete, solution-focused proposal. Like, I'm asking for these orders because this hasn't worked, and this is why I think this will work.
Right. And often are you in situations where you're bringing in the medical experts to explain to the court, like, let's say there's a disagreement, you know, over diagnoses or medicine, because I know that can be a really common one. And, you know, here in Florida or in our practice, we would need the medical testimony. We would need to educate the court as to, from an expert, why this child needs this, you know, if we if there's a disagreement. How would you go about that? Similarly?
So back to my last answer, which is it depends. It depends on your judge. You need to know if your judge is, so this is where it comes down to having an experienced attorney who's familiar with this particular courtroom and these types of decisions, because this doesn't come up in every case, right? So what I need to know is the judge going to actually make that decision, or is the judge going to pick the picker? Is the judge going to say, I don't need to hear from these experts. I just need to know that mom has never been to a single IEP meeting. Mom has never spoken to the pediatrician. Mom doesn't have the adequate information to make an educated decision in the kid's best interest. I'm going to let dad pick. And I don't care what the decision is, but dad is the better suited parent to make that decision. The judge is going to get, well, and sometimes you do need the experts to explain to the judge, look, mom refused to let the kid have these assessments or let the kid have this blood work done. So, you know, it's not in the kid's best interest to have mom in the position of making these decisions, or mom was right to not do those things. So sometimes you do need the expert even to help the court pick the picker.
Yeah. Because I would think that would be a big thing, clearly. And in my experience over the years, and in order for our court, based on the laws, to make that decision where, okay, mom, you get, within your words, legal custody over medical decisions. You get full decision making on that. They would have to see a pattern in a lot of history of action or non-action. And that, of course, and at the end of the day, is not in the best interest of the child. Is that your kind of experience as well?
Yes. I don't think that courts are in the business of disenfranchising either parent. And I think that the presumption is both parents should participate and there should be a joint. In fact, it's pretty much the default that parents should be able to make their own decision during their own custodial time. Obviously, that can't carry over if they are in a disagreement about what the diet is going to be or what school the kid's going to go to. It's not good enough to just say, do whatever you want during your custodial time. But that's what judges want to do. They want to stay out of the mix. They want to let parents parent, right? And we actually have a case in California that says that parents have the right to make their own parental decisions. And that's really the gist, right? So you're trying to tell a judge whose orientation is, I want both parents involved because I'm presuming both parents have the kid's best interest at heart and are capable of acting in the kid's best interest. But that isn't always the case. And so it's the lawyer's burden when we need to have the judge make an alternative determination. We need to tell the judge why and why it is not in the kid's best interest to go with that default.
And I think that's really important and good for our listeners to hear, because that's the reality of the situation. And it's really difficult. And I do have so much empathy for these poor children in the middle with conflicting views on their best treatment plan. Because even when the court intervenes, nobody's there. If you're not given the medicine when they're with you and you've been ordered to, it only hurts the child. But usually those are people who believe that the medication is more harmful than not. And it's very difficult. And particularly, we've already got a child who is clearly, has challenges. And the parents, and I think, on particularly like with, various autism and medications for even ADHD, generally, when people disagree, they vehemently disagree, right? It's just very much against their belief system rather than, I don't know that I like that medication. Do you find that they're just much more strong rooted in they're opposing one thing or advocating?
Yeah. And if I were the judge, I would want to know why. What's really going on here? Is this a philosophical thing, like you don't believe in medicating a kid? Mm-hmm. Or are you just being oppositional because you don't want mom to be the one to make the decisions? Are you just putting up a fight? And I see that so frequently. It's unfortunate. But sometimes people just want to be right. And they want to be right so much that they'll take a position even if they're not married to the philosophy behind that position. Or sometimes it's just really inconvenient. I don't want to take the kid to physical therapy during my weekend. I want to go to baseball games. Or I don't want to spend the money on that, you know, these hyperbaric chamber treatments, even though six doctors said it's in my kid's best interest. So there's so much nuance to this. It's really important to understand the motivation and by looking at all the facts.
Right, right. Now, and that leads to, because I think this helps with the facts and in the case, because on other podcasts, you've spoken about the role of a forensic expert and why this might be necessary in some cases. And I'd love for you to, you know, unpack a little, that a little for us and give us some examples of those kind of situations.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think the insight of what we would call a child custody evaluator in California, a mental health professional who really is experienced in the conflict that's involved in a family law scenario, they can really help untangle what is the dispute about. Is the kid acting out because of parental conflict, because of intimate partner violence, because there's so much drama in the house or conflict about the kid and decision, you know, pulling the kid in a tug of war between the parents? Or is the kid acting out because there's an underlying condition? And that's where the parents fight about the condition. No. You know, dad says that he's got this diagnosis, but it's really because dad is so mean to me and the kid is seeing that. So a forensic expert can help tease out what I believe is there's a presumption. I believe that the mental health professionals, therapists, or custody mediators, they tend to first go to the low-hanging fruit in a family law situation, which is conflict, parental conflict.
Yeah.
And so I need to, when I've got a client who's got a kid acting out, a kid having medical issues, a kid having constant asthma attacks, anxiety attacks, allergy attacks, is there some organic reason? And how are we going to find that out? So the forensic expert really is going to rely, just like the court, on the data we present. Like, okay, I know it's not parental conflict because I've taken the kid to the pediatrician and the pediatrician will tell the forensic expert, yeah, look, this rash isn't going to go away just because the parents aren't fighting anymore. We tried that and it didn't work. And so I like to get the beauty of the forensic approach is to collect all the data, to speak to all the providers and go in and talk to the behavior therapist. Oh, look, the kid is acting out in one house and not the other. That doesn't mean that one parent is better than the other or doing the right thing. It just means that that's where the kid is acting out. I get that question all the time. Like, oh, he doesn't do that in my house. It's just because she's such a bad parent. Well, no, it might have to do with the fact that your response to the behavior is different or he's afraid to like let it out in your house. So there's all these different approaches that a custody evaluator, somebody who's really trained in compiling all the data and using the data to help whittle down, we've ruled out this possibility, so it must be that possibility. But the real benefit of a forensic expert is the recommendation to the court. Here's what I've determined. Here's how I suggest, Your Honor, you approach this.
And I think that is very helpful. And that's a great explanation because they're also, I mean, one side, well, I'm sure hiring them or maybe the cost is split, but they are more objective, not the in coming in and really trying to look at all the factors because everything you've talked about, of course, influences the child's behavior and or health, right? The conditions, living conditions, one house versus the other, you know, the behaviors of the various parents or if there's new partners and even food. I mean, you know, the more I know that, you know, if we were talking with somebody who is very strictly adhering to a like non-sugar type diet for their kids. I'm kind of making this up. I've heard of these things before, but like, then they're like, oh my gosh. And then when he gives them sugar, like then they come turn into an irrational little Tasmanian devil. And you know, you need somebody in there maybe who is independent to really dig in. And then of course, give recommendations to the court and they've got the qualifications behind them and they've observed all these things. And, you know, for our listeners, that's why when your attorney is like, we need to hire, you know, we need to pay for this. This is why.
Yeah.
We're trying to have somebody, they're not speaking for your child, but they're speaking on behalf of your child based on all of those things, what in their expert opinion would be best. And I think the courts tend to listen to those.
Without a doubt. When I was a very young lawyer, I was on a panel speaking with a child custody evaluator and a bunch of judges about the use of a forensic expert to mediate a case. Their family law, you don't get to the point of having a custody hearing or a high conflict custody drama unless there is parental conflict that rises above your typical, you know, typical parental fighting. There are very few cases actually end up in trial over custody issues. But if they get to that point, they really need the court to intervene. Special needs cases are kind of different in that way because you could have a really low conflict parental environment, but they don't know what to do. They don't know how to solve this problem. So the use of a forensic expert in a special needs case doesn't necessarily signal to the judge high conflict. It signals to the judge, we've got a really special problem on our hands and we don't know how to approach it.
Right, right. I think that's good. And that's so important. And sometimes you're right. There isn't the conflict. The parents just don't really know. It's like, we really need some guidance. And then taking that guidance and creating some structure for the parents moving forward. Because let's talk about like specialized schooling and things like that. And when they've got, you know, the educational plans, the IEPs or, you know, 504, like how can that really be addressed by the court? And I would guess in a parenting plan, usually that's how we do it.
So those are what we call legal custody decisions, meaning are we going to have an IEP? And if we have an IEP or a 504, you know, what are we going to ask for? Are we going to hire a lawyer? The lawyer is going to require some symbiosis on the parent's part. They're going to require both parents' consent or authority. And then, you know, I get these cases all the time where the parents go together to the IEP and dad says, yes, we want speech therapy. And mom says, no, we don't. And then the cool school's like, great, cool. We don't want to pay for that anyway. We're going with mom.
Yeah.
So those are things that become both a legal custody problem and a physical custody problem. We you know, this trickles. It also becomes a financial child support problem. Who's going to pay for that therapy that dad doesn't want the kid to have? And is it necessary? And sometimes a judge is the only one who can make that decision.
Yeah. And now let's talk about those kind of things, because I think that is really important, the legal custody and making those decisions. And we, you know, we call it here parental responsibility. So it would be just sole parental responsibility on that issue, whether it's medical, education, or religion. Now, does the child... I would think yes, but I'd like to know, does the child's diagnosis need to be formal or official for the court to make those legal custody determinations?
Does the diagnosis, is that what you asked?
Yeah.
So no, there's no requirement that a diagnosis be official, but I'm going to assume that a judge will want to test the necessity of the provider, or the service, or whatever it is, that the special school, whatever the expense is. I think what we're talking about is an expense-driven problem.
Right.
And what does the court take into consideration when determining whether one parent should, whether the kid should go to a, let's say, a private school or a special school, and whether the parents should, each parent, what their responsibility respectively is from the financial contribution. So the court will probably, listen, if one parent says, look, dad made this whole thing up, their kid has no issues. What I see most commonly is a special, like a Linda Mood Bell or a dyslexia school placement. And you know, one parent says, this kid needs specialized attention and one-on-one and this special Linda Mood Bell approach to learning and blah, 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 blah. And the other parent says, what? Are you kidding me? Nobody's diagnosed the kid with that. Mom just came up with that. So whether there's a diagnosis or not, where did they get that diagnosis? How did they arrive at that diagnosis? Oh, they never interviewed the other parent. Those are going to be all relevant evidence in when the court has to make that decision.
And you're right. It tends to come down many times to cost. And, you know, as one of those evaluations. Now, this one is a big question because I know there's not just one answer. So, but I'm going to ask it and I know you'll answer it in the best way you think. But, you know, how do you create a parenting agreement, a parenting plan that is able to survive the evolving changes that children have? And of course, you know, if you're thinking, well, are they going to improve, worsen, or remain dependent beyond 18?
Okay, so in California, we can't control the custody parenting plan beyond the age of 18. We still have the right to seek child support for an adult, what we call adult disabled child beyond the age of majority, which isn't exactly 18. It's when they graduate high school or turn 19. But that's going to be state specific, right?
Okay, yes.
But the custody schedule, the parenting schedule evaporates at age 18. Who has the kid when and who makes decisions? That becomes an issue for the probate court. And you might need to seek a limited conservatorship is the answer if it's a developmental disability in California. It's a whole different court. It's a whole different ball of wax. It's not something we handle in family court. Yet, where the kid lives and what the decisions about the kid's care remains a family court issue if the court keeps jurisdiction to award child support over that child beyond the age of majority. So you could have a fight going on in the probate court about where does the kid live, what services do they get, who's going to be in charge of these decisions, while we go back across the hall to family court and fight out the money.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that would be similar in Florida because you do have to go through the probate court to get a guardianship once they're legally 18. So all the things that you've done up until that time, you're going to now need a court order to do that. But yes, the family law court does always retain jurisdiction if they are still dependent. And then this just came to mind, so I'm going to talk about it and ask you, because then sometimes though it will be necessary to submit, you know, an application for Social Security disability, and that might offset child.
Yes. And so my recommendation, and that's a huge, huge problem. Mm-hmm. And what I always recommend to clients who are dealing with a potential adult support issue is that they speak to an estate planning attorney who specializes in special needs, because a special needs trust is the way to protect the kid's eligibility for resources. And there are CalABLE accounts where you can deal with financial issues that won't jeopardize or compromise the kid's benefits. And you definitely, definitely need to have a consultation with an attorney who specializes in that area.
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely needed. You know, how often are you, like, as far as on a day-to-day basis, how contentious are these cases generally, do you think?
I'm in an unfortunate perspective because you don't need me unless you got a big conflict. So I don't get to play in the nice games. I get to play in the little mini wars. So most of my cases come to me because they've got family law attorneys who have a situation on their hands and they realize that special needs issues are pervading the process. And they're like, oh my God, I don't even know what they're talking about with this alphabet of BCBAs and ABAs and what is happening. And they're fighting over who's gonna get the IHSS funding and the SSI. And I don't know what this means. You need Carrie. So I get the really high level drama cases, and that's how I like it. But that's because those cases need my perspective and my experience. But most cases, I would say, I truly believe that every family law case needs to really factor in the particularized needs of the kids of the family. And unfortunately, more often than not, kids have issues, whether they're chronic and ongoing and profound, or they're minor and maybe the kid breaks an ankle at a baseball game. But that kid then becomes, have some special needs, even if it's just temporary. And when you're dealing with parental conflict on top of that, it's never easy. It never helps the situation.
Yeah. Now let's talk about this, because I have a feeling you have some good insight on this, because how do you recommend and how do you advise, say, our listeners who may be going through this or something similar, right, with a special needs child, divorce, either going through it or post-divorce, how do you advise that they really take care of themselves emotionally? Because we know that's very important, and physically, frankly, you know, when they're dealing with all of this and then added litigation on top of caring for a child with special needs.
So just like I would advise them to make sure the child has some wellness help and support in place, a therapist, meditation, yoga, self-care, any way you can find it, I really find that parents who resist allowing or wanting the kids to go to the other parent's house don't really appreciate the fact that they need that respite. They need that time to themselves to just self-evaluate and repair. They need a break. I mean, most in California, we have regional center. They will provide respite funds so that a parent gets a break and not to go to work. There's childcare for going to work. But respite is really about you need a break. When you've got a kid with special needs, more often than not, it's going to take a huge physical and emotional toll on the parent. So is the divorce, right?
Right.
So combine, I have all of my clients, special needs kids or not, make sure you have a therapist or a support group or even a Facebook group of divorcing mommies or special needs mommies. But you've got to get support from people who understand and appreciate your situation. And unfortunately, parents of special needs kids going through family law crises have two environments they need support from. But the typical divorcing mommies or the typical special needs mommies may not appreciate the overlay.
Yeah. And you answered that question, I think, which is, you know, probably specific to California, but, you know, with the respite care, because we've had cases over time where, you know, there's the divorce and the dad just doesn't want anything to do. So there's no other parent who's showing up, even when they have been granted time. And that is, I just can't imagine, but I know it's overwhelming and it's exhausting and there's no real relief.
Well, from personal experience, yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's a huge burden to go through a divorce with a kid with special needs. And it's even more so when there's no outlet. I mean, it certainly reduces the conflict if you're not fighting over a parenting plan. But believe me, the reward is not worth the price.
Yeah. And now, have you seen cases where, you know, and I would imagine this to be true, even in Florida, because we do look at overnights. And so, but, you know, you can add into child support or, you know, go beyond the formula for things like that. Because obviously you need to have, you deserve to have some kind of child care. And even if they won't help you take care of the child physically, maybe you can get, you know, more in child support or monetarily get some, a little bit more relief than normal in those cases.
Yes, this is a huge issue. And when I evaluate the child support issues in a case like this, I approach it in two ways. I ask the court to deviate. We have child support guidelines in California that the courts have to follow. It's a computer program. They can, but our law allows the court to deviate from the guideline in special circumstances, and they specifically have codified having a kid with special needs meets that presumption. So it comes down to the lawyer putting on all the evidence about why the court should deviate from the guideline, and also our code allows for add-on expenses, childcare expenses, or medical expenses, health, education, and welfare, those types of expenses, we can ask for a disproportionate share to be able to not only deviate from guideline, but maybe also have the lower time parent contribute more. It really is income-based, but it's also timeshare-based. We evaluate child support and add those add-on expenses based on how much income each parent has and how much time that parent has with the kids.
I think that is so important. So listeners, like if you are involved in this in any way, you make sure these are conversations you're having with your lawyer because you got to bring it up. Of course, it's not going to order and you've got to have the proof, but it can make a big difference.
Huge difference.
Absolutely. Well, this has been an amazing conversation. I cannot believe we're out of time so soon, but I knew we would. It's fascinating to me. And I know so many of our listeners are going through these kinds of things. Sherry, before we go, can you impart on our listeners what you've learned about women and their resilience throughout your career and experience?
So I'm always so proud to see female, usually working moms, rise to the level of family law judges, minors counsel, child custody evaluators, and judges. And really, I love to see the legal system dominated by working moms who have been through these struggles themselves and can give back from the bench.
Well, that is awesome. And lastly, Carrie, where can our listeners find you for more information and resources?
I have a website. It's pineslawgroup.com, and that's how I'm reachable.
Awesome. Well, we've reached the end of our show today. Thank you so much, Carrie Pines, for joining us to discuss how to handle disagreements between co-parents about diagnoses, medication, and treatment for a child with special needs, legal strategies and tools to protect your child's best interests during divorce and co-parenting, and navigating evolving care needs, school accommodations, and your own well-being throughout the process. Thank you so much, Carrie.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Listeners, if you or someone you know in the Northeast Florida area is going through or even thinking about divorce, you're not alone. Taking that first step can feel overwhelming. But it doesn't have to be. Our newsletter is filled with actionable advice tailored to guide you through this process. By signing up, you'll gain the tools to face the unknown with courage and see if we're the right fit to support you during this life-changing time. Don't wait. Click the link in the show notes, fill out the form, and take the first step toward building a brighter future today.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not an advertisement for legal services. The information provided on this podcast is not intended to be legal advice. If you have a legal issue, please contact an attorney in your local jurisdiction. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are solely those of the individuals and do not represent the views or opinions of the firms or organizations with which they are affiliated. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Any editing, reproduction, or redistribution of this podcast for commercial use or monetary gain without the expressed written consent of the podcast's creator is prohibited.